Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on reality behind the news right after this. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of our two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of this alleged crime, and what should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, and rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and then shut up. Now, after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, you can click on to the archives page and download that free general law CD package right there. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, and then go to the archives page to download that free general law CD package. All right, we're talking about reality behind the news. Last time, I took you through the bankruptcy, the impending bankruptcy of the European Union. Now, the United States of America is going to go through this bankruptcy. Great Britain is in the beginning stages of it. France is now insolvent. Now, France and Germany are the two big powerhouses over in Europe. And the other day, the French are being drugged down. You know, by the time they bailed out Greece, it drug them down to the point now they're insolvent. They're still making their payments every month. But we can now see that the French aren't going to be able to make their payments under the current debt structure unless something changes, you know, at some point in the future. Now, all of a sudden, here comes Ireland into the game, and then Spain's going to come. And what I said last time was that it's going to drag down those countries that are still solvent. Now, in the Money Changer, there was a story put out by Franklin Sanders, and he said, side by side, building a new economy without waiting for the old economy to collapse. And I read the article, and I said, you know, Frank's making pretty good sense here. Now, I would like to see my government officials, my president and my senators and representatives, take a look at the reality of Europe and China and outsourcing of jobs and tariffs and so on, and tax policy, and make some decisions that benefit truck drivers and housewives. That's what I would like to see. But that's not going to happen because the truck drivers and housewives are not in control of the government of the United States. the major corporations, you know, outfits like General Electric and General Motors, and the banks such as Goldman Sachs and Bank of America. Those are the people who are in control of America, and those are the people that make our policy, and those are the policies that are going to be enacted to benefit Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, General Motors, and General Electric. And the rest of us ought to wake up to that reality. It doesn't benefit the majority of Americans, but it benefits a bunch of people. The policies that are being followed here in the United States benefit a lot of people in the world, and probably the people that count, you know, the people that are the movers and shakers, you know, like Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller. It benefits them, and they're the people that count. By God, that's the policy we're going to follow. So, little Georgie Gordon has to live here on planet Earth along with David and Henry and Barack and, you know, Nancy and Harry and the rest of them. And so, what am I going to do? They're sitting there saying that I should work and pay taxes and turn the money over to David and Henry and the rest of the big corporations and bail them out. And I'm sitting over here saying, you know, hold on a second, I'm not so sure I want to do that. So what are my options? What do you and I, the truck drivers and the workers and the laborers and the housewives and the mothers and, you know, soccer moms and so on, what's our input? What's our options? Are we forced into doing this against our will and over our objection, or is there a choice to be made? Well, surprisingly in the Bible, in a number of places, but particularly in Deuteronomy 30 and Joshua 6, a choice is laid out. The Ten Commandment model of economics and politics allows for you and I to make a choice. In fact, our Creator, our God, tells us in plain language, choose you this day who you're going to serve. Now, the powers that be don't offer choice. They send us to public school. They send us to colleges and universities, and they train us up in the way we should go. And they don't offer us choice. They offer us a duty and obligation. And they tell us plainly, this is your duty, now get out and do it. God's a little bit different. He comes along and says, well, it is true, there is duty here, but I'm going to give you the opportunity to choose whether you want to select duty and responsibility, or you want to choose licentiousness and the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And then we know when you make your choice, there'll be an outcome, and then we'll go with the outcome. Well, Franklin Sanders comes along and he says, you know, before the world's economy collapses, why don't we build our own economy in our local area? Why don't we as individuals and families right here at the local level concentrate on weathering this storm? And I thought, well, you know, that just makes all the sense in the world. Do I have to sit back here on my hands and wait for the European Union to collapse and the United States to go into insolvency and the dollar to become worthless and hyperinflation to take over and ravish my business and my family and my farm? Or is there something I could do in advance? And the answer is, yeah, there's a lot we can do in advance, and here's the story. Side by side, building a new economy without waiting for the old to collapse. And Franklin starts off, he says, in my library you'll find books by very smart people from the 1930s that predicted the imminent collapse of the American economy. And then in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, people have never been able to conceive how rich this American economy was, and how flexible the American people, and how much abuse that this economic system could absorb. Now, there are two ghosts here. Two ghosts haunt and distract us from building a new economy. The first ghost is that government action or money is necessary. And the second ghost is that the present economy must collapse first before we can build a replacement. And then there's a monster. Now, because we live with this monster, we grew up with this monster, and we witness this monster every day, we can't realize what a monster and what an aberration our economy is and has become. Its fundamental preposition or presupposition is that the state must run the economy. That comes from the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And it was only born with the communists and the socialists 160 years ago. So, boys and girls, the idea that governments or states run your economy is fairly new in the 5,000-year history of mankind. It's only been around for 160 years. It was never practiced until World War I commandeered economies, and never thoroughly in this country until the fascists took over the United States economy, was completed by the Roosevelt New Deal in the 1930s. That takeover took place in two steps. The first step was the 1913 establishment of the Federal Reserve Bank, which surrendered monetary control to the fascists. The second phase took place in 1933 when the New Deal seized operational control of the economy. Fascism, I want to remind you, is a big business and government partnership where government runs the nation and the economy for the benefit of big business, and that's what we're witnessing today. This government bailout here of the banks and General Motors and so on, that's fascism. That's the conclusion to the Roosevelt New Deal and the Harry Truman Fair Deal proposals and programs. And that took 20 years to put into operational control, and that's what we wanted, and that's what we voted for, and so here's the outcome of it. Now, I don't like this outcome, and I'm not going to ride this ship to the bottom of the ocean. If the rest of you want to stay on the ship and ride her to the bottom, you know, be my guest. I'm getting off. Now, the second head of this monster is the reliance on debt. And throughout history, men have understood that you can build prosperity on production only, and you cannot build prosperity on debt and speculation. Now, our economy substitutes debt for production and then monetizes the future, not the solid past and present. Now, until 1980, our laws forbade usury, and defining that usury as interest greater than 10%. Now, I want to put a little note here in the margin, and I want to point out to you that our Creator said that there's no usury at all permitted under the Ten Commandment law. So, you know, if you want to add in your part and say, well, God, you know, your level is too low. When I was a kid, 6% was called reasonable interest, and over that was usury. I can't remember 10% being applied anywhere. I'm not saying that it wasn't, but 9% in North and South Carolina was the legal limit, you know, back in the 40s and 50s when I was a youngster. Now, it's been raised today. Hell, credit card companies, they routinely charge you 28% or more, but, you know, usury was 6% or more. Now, in the Bible, when we look at the law of God, there is zero. If you were to charge somebody 0.01% interest on a loan, it would be a violation of the law. So it's not a matter of how much constitutes usury. It is any interest or gain charged on a loan is usury, and it's prohibited. So I just want to bring that to your attention. Now, those laws have been swept away before this all-powerful and these all-powerful banks and usurers, and they now give us credit card and their credit card issuers, and they charge 28% interest for using their private, self-created money, and no one blanches. So, 10% is small potatoes. I don't know of any credit card company charging 10%. they're all 15, 20, 30%. And worse yet, at check discounters and title loan companies, the poor pay up to 800% a year. 800% interest. Nobody bats an eyelid at that. But the scripture denounces a person who takes usury from the poor as the same as one who takes a bribe to denounce an innocent person. Now, debt actually chokes off economic growth, since every dollar born in debt today must be fed a dollar of interest tomorrow, and all of our money is borrowed into circulation. So we borrow the money into circulation and then pay interest on it. Now keep this in mind. It's called the Rule of 72. The Rule of 72. If you borrow $1,000 at 10% interest, and I'll show you how this works. We punch in 72 divided by 10, and it's, see if I've got this right, 72 divided by, 10, equals 7.2. The $1,000 will multiply to $2,000 in 7.2 years. So now you're going to owe $2,000. Well, the $2,000 at 10% interest in 7.2 years will multiply to $4,000. The $4,000 will multiply to 8 in another 7.2 years. So if you borrowed $1,000 at 10% interest, and this carried out for 22 years, you would owe $1,000, $2,000, $4,000, and then the next doubling period would be $8,000. Can you follow that? And then $16,000, $32,000, $64,000, $128,000, and so on. That's why usury and interest will run your economy into bankruptcy. And it doesn't take forever, you know, just from 1913 to the present, and there you are. This doubling has run our debt from a couple of billion dollars back in 1910 to pushing $14 trillion today. A trillion is 1,000 billion. So from $2 billion in debt in 1910 to we have 1,000 billion, so that's 14,000 billion dollars. 14 trillion is 14,000 billion dollars. Hey, that's a bunch of money, ain't it? Hey, if we keep doing that, we'll be talking about real money here pretty shortly. All right, so the debt burden just keeps on growing, and if the money supply ever stops growing, the baby quickly starves. Now, that's the lunatic economy that we live under today, but we're all blind to it. After all, we were taught how to use it when we went to school, remember? We all went to public school. Well, until it begins to creak and crumble and lurch and its running sores and cancers are revealed, as it is being revealed today, leaving us to wonder whether in reality it can survive. And the answer is it cannot survive. Now, in the scripture, every 50 years, God has a resetting. It's called the Jubilee year. And everybody forgives everybody else's debt in the Jubilee year, which is, by the way, coming up in 2012. The next Jubilee is, it's 2013. 2012 will be the land Sabbath year, and then 2013 will be the Jubilee. And then the next Jubilee will be 2063, and so on. And then it's a recounting. It's to level the playing field once every 50 years so that the poor don't end up being in perpetual credit debt servitude. Now, one of the ways that we could use to straighten out our national economy is to declare a jubilee. And then we forgive everybody's debt and everybody goes back to square one. We start over. Now, of course, the players that be, the powers that be, they're not going to buy into that. All of you people who are in debt would like to do that. Wipe out your debt and start over at zero. And all the people who have or hold that debt are sitting there saying, no way, Jose, I want to keep that guy working for me. And so that's the system that you have. So one is the Ten Commandments system, and the other is the Ten Plank system. And we're working under this Ten Plank system, and it's in the process of collapsing, which it always has in the past, is now, and will always do in the future. And there's traumatic, very, very traumatic consequences that come from it. You know, so what we're living through right now isn't bad. It's not good, but it's not really bad. Bad is yet to come, worse right after that, and then terrible, and then disastrous, and then catastrophic, and then, you know. But it'll work itself out. It always does. We are going to realign all of the debt structure of the world through an agonizing process called bankruptcy. We could do it through a jubilee. We could do it voluntarily, but we won't. Or as my dad said, now we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way. Now how do you want to do that? You know, and so you can do it the easy way or you can do it the hard way. Now we're going to do it the hard way. Make up your mind to that. The powers that be that are in power, they've decided that that's what we're going to do, and so the rest of us are going to get drug along whether we like it or not. And Franklin Sanders is asking the question, well, do you really want to do that? And so my answer is, no, I don't. Now, here's what the ghost of collapse is all about. We seem to believe that, first, the economy must collapse before we can build a replacement. But why? Why do I have to wait for 300 million other people to come to their senses before I take action? Is that the way of nature, or does the next generation come up alongside the first and then gradually take over from them? Why can't I start living free right now? Why can't I start building my future today? Now, I can't find a reason. And it seems to me that if I have something somebody else wants, and if this other person is willing to pay me for it, then we've got a deal, assuming I'm not selling dope or nuclear weapons. There's no reason I have to wait until everybody else goes broke, or until everybody else wants what I sell and every condition is absolutely perfect. Hey, just take a look around you. The U.S. economy may be in trouble, but it isn't collapsing yet. Government is still supporting over half the people of the nation, and as long as government makes good on that promise, they have no reason to change the way that they're doing business. A crowd of facts argues that largesse cannot continue. It will, at some point in the future, be discontinued. It's going to stop. Now, the question that jumps out at us is this. At what point can the producers no longer support the non-producers in our society? Right now, less than half of the produce for the whole. All right, let me point this out. At this moment in time, 51% of the people of America receive some form of government check. They're receiving some kind of support from government. You are a veteran from Iraq and you were injured in the war and you're on the government dole. And maybe you should be, and maybe that's a legitimate expense. I'm not just sitting here arguing about it. Or maybe you're unemployed, and you're on unemployment insurance. You're receiving a government check, and maybe you should. I wouldn't argue with you there. But at what point do the people who are non-producers and receivers overwhelm the producers? At what point? How many producers does it take to support the people that are not working on unemployment, or the people who are crippled and injured, or have lost a leg and, you know, or an arm or something like that, and they can't work? Well, 100 of us could support one. Well, then can 100 of us support two? Yeah, I think so. Can 100 of us support four? Probably. Could 100 of us support eight? It's starting to tell, but yeah. Could 100 of us support 16? Yeah, probably we could if we put our minds to it. Well, then could 100 of us support 32 non-producers? Well, then could 100 of us support 64 non-producers? Well, then could 100 of us support 128 non-producers? Let's suppose that we could. Well, then could 100 of us support 256 and 512 and 1,024 non-producers? See, boys and girls, the reality of life is this. As much as we may want to support these non-producers, the reality, the physics of the problem tells us that at some point in time, you will not have enough physical energy in your body to support one other person, two other people, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And the problem and the debt is growing geometrically. Now, in 1900, virtually no one was on the dole. We didn't have a dole for you to get on. So if you couldn't take care of yourself, your family had to do it, or the church or somebody else. With the socialist takeover in the 1930s, they said, well, this is a government responsibility, and so we're going to put it on the taxpayers. And they have added the number of people that are on the dole until today. 51% are now receiving some, not all necessarily, but some, government support. That means 49% of us are supporting, to some degree, 51 others. And it's still functioning. Now, it's weak, it's shaky, it's not looking good. But, you know, it's still, you know, as of last night, it was still working. Okay, well, now when this gets up to 60, 65, 70, 75%, you know, what's it going to look like then? And when will it collapse? I don't know. I'm not sitting here giving you a date and telling you here, you know, in 2020 it's going to collapse. I haven't got a clue. I'm not a prophet. But I can see that as these trends continue, you know, more and more people want to get on the dole. Here in my county, Ozark County, 6,500 of the people in the county, the population about 10,000, 6,500 of the people in this county are on Social Security, welfare, or some form of government aid or welfare. 65%. Last time I saw a number, 27% were unemployed. Well, hell, boys and girls, only 7% of the people in this county are producers. 93% of the people in Ozark County produce little or nothing. 7% of us take care of ourselves. And now, I'm not supporting the other 93%, not claiming to. It takes outside help. The federal government sends money here, and the state government sends money here. And it's maybe a foible that we don't have any industry in the county. Nobody here works. Well, you know, a few do. Little tourist trade. How long can that continue? If it weren't for you taxpayers in California supporting the other people in this county, they would have starved to death long ago. The 7% of us that are working could not have taken on that burden. I don't believe that 7 people can support 100. Maybe they can, but I find that hard to believe. So the question arises here, you know, how long can this continue? And the answer is, we can see that it won't go on forever, but we don't know when. But we can see that it's a lot closer today than it was 10, 20, or 30 years ago, can't we? So let's face it, at what point does this thing break down? Now, many people do not want to be free. They don't want to take responsibility for feeding themselves, let alone competing and running a business. They don't even want to make their own decisions. Freedom scares these people, and I understand that. And I have to wonder, though, maybe they have simply never known the great pleasure of working and preparing something that another person sees and recognizes that there's value in it and then buys it. Maybe these people have never heard that heartfelt thank you. Maybe they've been told so many times in so many ways, including public education, that they're not capable of taking on for themselves the responsibility for their own lives, that they have finally come to believe it, and maybe they really aren't capable of taking care of themselves. But boys and girls, in the end, almost all of these folks are passive. They don't stand in the way. They're not going to fight the old economy or the new economy. They're just going to eat whatever's on their plate, and they'll be taking it from whoever they can get it from. They're not producers, like drone bees in a hive. They produce nothing and consume much. In the end, there's no reason that you and I must wait for the economy to collapse before we begin to build our new economy right now. In fact, our circumstances would be much worse if we wait. It's better to start building today and preparing and planning, spinning together that web of relations and contacts that makes an economy work, getting that experience, solving the problems before hyperinflation or transportation disruptions or violence make any economy totally impossible. So we simply start to work now, whether the economy collapses or not, and then little by little, the old economy simply fades away, because you and I will be building a better, more just, and durable economy. Now, every one of us has an economy. You have your own local, little, personal, family economy. Now, is your economy dependent upon a paycheck that comes in every week, or is your economy dependent upon cows or milk that you sell every week, or is it dependent upon something that you produce for others, you know, like batteries or battery cables or some product that you make and you sell in the marketplace? How much demand do you think is going to be out there in the marketplace for flowers? You know, when people have to decide between eating, paying the rent, and buying flowers, I think they're going to pay the rent, buy the food, and they will postpone buying the flowers. So right away, in your economic preparations, you should start thinking about what is really necessary for people to live, and what is it that is fluff. Nice. It's nice to have flowers. I don't deny that. But, you know, we can live a long time without flowers, and we can't live nearly as long without pinto beans and cornbread. And life is going to be better with a roof over our heads than flowers over our heads. That's the reality of the circumstance. Hey, it's halfway time, and I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by asking for it. Call and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Now, keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing an article written by Franklin Sanders in his journal. It's called The Money Changer, published in November. This is last month's issue, November 2010. It's entitled Side by Side, Building a New Economy Without Waiting for the Old Economy to Collapse. The Money Changer, and a copy of it, can be obtained from The Money Changer, Post Office Box 178, West Point, Tennessee. And the zip code is 38486. Once more, that's The Money Changer, P.O. Box 178 in West Point, Tennessee, 38486. I'd call him first. The telephone number is 888-218-9226. Once more, that's 888, I think that's toll-free, 218-9226. Now, Franklin Sanders is unique. He writes these articles. He puts out a journal here, a newsletter, once a month, and he'll put in four or five articles in each edition. But the thing that sets him apart, not only is he an economist, but he also uses what I call just street sense. You know, my granddad used to call it common sense, but just street sense. In sizing up a problem and then, well, what in the hell are we going to do about it? Now, in the last program, I told you about the god-awful problem that the European Central Bank and the European Union is facing. The European Union, this gigantic, huge, 400 million people in 28 nations is on the abyss. It's going to collapse. Why do I say that? Because great nations, city-states, and empires like the Roman Empire and the Egyptian Empire and the Third Reich, they've all collapsed in the past. Wake up, smell the coffee. And they're not any different, and they're on the abyss. And now the great American experiment. You know, the great American colossus, empire. We're on the verge of collapse. The old British Empire. You know, Great Britain is still there. And the English people are still there. But their empire is gone. You know, when I was a kid, the sun never set on the British Empire. Today, there's no empire. It's gone. Great Britain's still there. America will still be here, but the American Empire is going to be gone. In the process of doing that, things change. Things change. And, you know, you were making money and you were running your own business and it went bankrupt, and so now you're out working for wages again. You know, I don't know if you've ever been through that. I've been through that a couple of times, you know. I was in the business world and then I went upside down and oh my God, now I got to wake up. Now, there are some big successes in the world. You know, Colonel Chicken was a big success, but he didn't succeed till he was 65. So some of us are slow. You know, some of us takes us some time. Now, Franklin Sanders is taking on the world economy the way it is. And he's reading his newspaper just like I do and you do and everybody else, but he sees something different here. He says, you know, these guys aren't going to change. They're not going to change their policy at Goldman Sachs. The Democratic Party of America is not going to change their philosophy. And so they're going to continue on borrowing money and amassing debt and practicing Keynesian economics just like we always have until it finally collapses in hyperinflation. And then there will be social upheavals and maybe revolution, and there will be blood in the streets and martial law and wage and price controls. And oh, my God. Now, you know, the question arises, well, did you want to do this from your condominium across from Central Park in downtown Manhattan, or did you want to do this in Wichita, Kansas? Choice is yours. I thought Wichita might have a couple extra people there that I didn't need to support, and so my thinking would be that maybe Garden City, Kansas might be a better place to go to. And Garden City, you know, is a pretty good-sized little little place. And so, you know, maybe Theodosia, Missouri might be a little better. And so I looked at Theodosia and I said, nah, I think I'll get a farm out here. And, you know, I'm about 5 miles from Theodosia. That's plenty close enough. Now, most of you people don't want to get out here in the countryside and on a farm. And I understand that. You probably wouldn't know what to do with a live chicken if I gave you one, so you might as well plan on going down to McDonald's and eating McNuggets. But, you know, just in case, have you thought about what you're going to sell and where you're going to work and what you're going to do to feed, clothe, and house your family wherever you're located in the world today? I've got a daughter over in South Korea. I hope she's planning for a war there in the South. It's coming, you know. It hasn't happened for the last 40 or 50 years. The war ended, you know, in 53, and so now 50 years later, you know, the North is still armed, still threatening to take over the South, and at some point in time there's going to be war. I don't know how the war is going to come out, whether the South will win or the North will win, but there's going to be war there. And the opening round of war isn't going to be in North Korea. The opening round of war is going to be in the South. It'll be the North attacking the South. I don't think the South is going to attack the North, which would be to their advantage. Since war is coming, the guy that strikes first probably would would get a couple of good licks in first. But no, I kind of suspect that. And now she's living right there in Seoul, South Korea, and when they cut loose, she's going to be, I hope she's making some preparations for that. Does she have an underground shelter? She works at the university. Is there a shelter at the university? I don't know. I guess I ought to ask her. So, you know, wherever you're at, you need to make some preparations and plans. And this is why I'm suggesting that Franklin Sanders in his newsletter is a good newsletter to subscribe to. That's why I'm glad I have it. I'm glad that Frank wrote this article, and I'm going to report it to you. Now, here's the ghost of government. The biggest hurdle that we face in building a new economy is government. Not just how to sidestep all of these regulations, but how to get folks to understand that we don't need government to run our economy. We do not need government as the partner of every business transaction in our business. And the fact is that unless the knives and guns come out and the shooting starts, we don't need government at all. Government is there to protect us from other people who are going to bring out their knives and guns and threaten us. That's why we put government in place. We don't need government here to take care of us or to regulate our business transactions. But there is a lure of government money. And it's this lure of government money that hypnotizes everyone. Now think of all of the good things that we can do with that government money. Why, it's free money in our pocket. Well, I'm sorry to report to you that that is not free money in your pocket. It is pure poison. Now, since I began talking to the late Charles Walters of Acres USA about this subject of government largesse many years ago, I've been trying to find the mechanism behind the axiom that government money always decapitalizes the taker. When you take government money, it always impoverishes you. You take a look at everybody that takes government money and show me one millionaire. Go ahead, show me one. Behind all doubt, I know that is true, but I have been struggling to understand the mechanism. So maybe it's this. Those who accept government money are refusing to grow up and make their business work as a freestanding, profitable undertaking. They appear to make a profit, but when you subtract the government money, they have a loss, just like General Motors. All of these big corporations, you know, that take all of this government money, all of these universities that take this government money, every one of them is insolvent. They're all broke. Think of that. Therefore, they never learn how to make their businesses work. Over time, the government and the government money and the government money takers become weaker and weaker, less and less able to stir themselves up to the exertion, the accurate thinking, and the diligent labor that is needed to serve their neighbors and make a profit. Their own capital is being steadily consumed, but the government money stealthily hides the loss. Eventually, their capital is all eaten away, and the government money taker goes bankrupt, wondering what happened to him. He didn't become unprofitable the year he went bankrupt. He was unprofitable all along, but the government money hid that unprofitability, and it sapped his will to learn and his will to fight until it was too late to cure. He became unprofitable the day he first took that government money. So there's this lure of the government as savior. Taking government help is as deadly an error as taking government money. Whenever government is called in, it takes over the industry and it makes its original purpose impossible. Take the government organic label, as Charles Walters once told me. I told those damn hippies not to go to the government, but they wouldn't listen. And all of the necessary standards could have been set up and enforced by a private voluntary operation. But no, these naive actually believed that having government set organic standards would solve all of the problems in the organic food industry. Instead, it worked as government regulation always works. Before the laws had even been proposed, let alone enacted, big corporations had seized control to write those laws benefiting the big corporations and shutting out their competition, which is the purpose for regulation. It's to limit and shut out the competition. So today, we have milk raised in confinement animal feeding operations called CAFOs, where the cows eat little or no fresh grass and spend their lives on concrete. But the milk still qualifies as organic. Same thing goes for free-range organic eggs, where 25,000 chickens are free-range because their house has a door to it, 12 by 12 feet fenced yard. This is an agricultural example. But government control results in the same mess across the spectrum of economic activity. Whether it's in agriculture or in manufacturing, it's always the same. Government help always gets it wrong. And it always favors the big corporations, and it always shuts out and eventually destroys all of the little competitors. The interests benefiting from government regulation are alert, they are powerful, they are wealthy, and already have plenty of politicians in their bed. Those who are opposed or robbed by government regulation are weak, they're scattered, they're distracted, and difficult to organize and concentrate for any opposition. So, like it or not, the axiom always holds true. Government help always destroys those who need help most, and then it destroys everybody else. So there's only one cure. And the only cure that I can find for our wretchedness is simply to live free or die. Not years from now, when everything collapses, or the atmosphere is perfect, or my feet don't stink anymore, but today, insisting on sanity, even though we live in an insane world. So we begin doing all the work that we know will be profitable and fruitful and good for ourselves and others, whatever that enterprise may be. Building a new economy side by side with the old and watch the old one die. We operate on equity, not debt. That is, we finance ourselves. We don't borrow money. Or if we must, we borrow money from individuals who have it, but never from banks who create it out of thin air. Then we operate with equity, giving full measure for full measure, and even more, to make sure that we give our customer his full due. We then operate with integrity. Giving and requiring justice always does. No running and whining to lawyers and courts and government agencies when someone does wrong and refuses to repent, simply writing off his defalcation and shunning him until he makes good and does right, making good ourselves whenever we're charged with error. We operate in reality, and we produce physical goods or a necessary service, not financial speculating or uselessly churning and trading. We operate locally, seeking out our neighbors first as economic partners for everyday transactions. And then we operate with charity, recalling always that we cannot prosper unless our neighbors prosper. So we help them as much as we can. We operate without government help. We operate without government money. And we're always mindful that government help destroys those who take it. And that the impossible isn't impossible. So by now you may be thinking that I'm crazy and this is all impossible. The government economy is too big, too well entrenched, too cruel, and too vindictive and tyrannical. It's impossible to build anything beside it. Well, I may be crazy here, but that's the way I intend to live. And more than that, I've looked into the future, and I have a version of what I want and what I want the world to look like for my children and my grandchildren and great-grandchildren 100 years from now. No eye will ever see that vision unless I myself begin making it happen today. Today, I'm building for 100 years from now. Now, who in the world wouldn't want to take that trip? Well, let me tell you a little story here. You know, I'm running a law school here, just like Franklin Sanders is running his business, his newsletter. He's also a gold broker and trader. I just thought I'd throw that out there. If you want to know who to buy gold from and silver, you know, and where a lot of times people call me and say, well, where do I buy gold and silver? Now, I have a local broker here, but, you know, if I don't use my local broker, I could always call Franklin. In fact, Bob Chapman at the International Forecaster is also a gold broker, gold and silver broker. And we have to operate our businesses within the laws of the United States. Now, when these laws are passed, these laws and regulations aren't passed to benefit us or you. They are passed to benefit the big corporations at our expense. Now, I'm operating a law school here, and I operate here without any government aid. We don't participate in government largesse. I'm not borrowing money from banks. We operate with the Ten Commandment model, not the Ten Plank model. Now, I'm an old man now, and I could qualify for Social Security, but I don't need it, number one. And number two, I don't want to become dependent upon it. I don't want it. I'll take care of myself. And I'm not begrudging those of you that are on Social Security. Hey, listen, Social Security is bankrupt, in case you didn't know. And whatever's in there is going to be needed for those people that are in need of Social Security, and I'm not one of them. even though millionaires can draw Social Security because they paid into it, it isn't because they need it. So, as Franklin Sanders pointed out, why don't we use a little charity here? If I were to take my Social Security benefits today, it would make me dependent upon government. It would destroy me. It would destroy my character. I don't need it and don't want it. And it would interfere with those that truly are in need of it. So why don't I just leave it alone? And then let the guy over here that's really in need of it. You know, if all of us here in America did the same thing, hell, that Social Security might survive. But it isn't going to happen that way. That isn't the way most people think. They're not Franklin Sanders out there saying, hey, what can I do to take care of myself? Now, the thing that I admire about Franklin here is that he's saying, in effect, I will take care of the Sanders family. And then he expects George Gordon to take care of the Gordon family. And then I accept my responsibility, Franklin. I'll take care of the Gordons, you take care of the Sanders. Now, as a result of that, we have to have a profit. And out of our profits, I can buy from Franklin, and Franklin can buy from me. That's what makes a local private economy. That's what made America and our westward migration work and work so well. People left, and they went out onto the plains, and they built little sod houses in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And they planted seeds in the ground, and they harvested their crops, and they sold them. By 1900, those same people that were living in sod houses in the 1860s and 70s in Omaha, Nebraska, were building great big Victorian houses with wrought iron fences that filled in a whole block and were built of 20 or 30 rooms. And, you know, those that weren't building big mansions in Omaha were building houses. And they were buying and paying cash for them. And they owned those houses that cost them $7,000 to build in 1910, free and clear. They weren't going to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. They weren't involved with government. The government wasn't running their economy. That didn't happen until after the Federal Reserve. And you know, these bankers came to us and they said, hey, what we need is a Federal Reserve Bank over here, and that's gonna make you people rich. It's going to benefit everybody. It doesn't. That was a lie. It benefits the banks. It benefits the wealthy. But it doesn't benefit us little guys down here at the bottom of the pond. And the thing that benefits us little guys down here at the bottom of the pond is customers that buy our products. That's what benefits us. And when the government comes in here and gives us these low-interest loans, all that does is make us dependent on government and gives the big corporations the opportunity to come in and take over. And that's what they've done to organic food. The big corporations, you know, like General Mills and Cargill and ADM, they've come in bottom up. That's what happened. Because those people who were self-sufficient, self-reliant, bought into the swan song of the government can do it better for you. Let's all get together. Let's all join the economy. Again, Franklin Sanders' telephone number is 888-218-9226. That's 888-218-9226. Hey, I'm out of time. I've got to give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, around the world, in more than 120 countries daily, over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So, until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.